Welcome back to the Combat Learning Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Josh Peacock, fourth degree black belt in Taekwondo and a martial arts skill training specialist. If you're new to the show, please sign up at the Combat Learning Newsletter by going to combatlearning.com/newsletter. I'll send you cheat sheets on how to transform your drills into maximum skill building games and put you up to speed on the science of motor skill learning for martial arts. Plus, you'll never miss a show. Go to combatlearning.com/newsletter now to get those resources. The good news is that the ecological approach is gaining steam fast in the jiu-jitsu world. The bad news is that the bad faith arguments and big misunderstandings are already bogging down the message. One of the biggest charges leveled against ecological training is that the terminology around it is not just too technical, but in fact, meaningless. This is a bizarre accusation, but it's being repeated all over YouTube, Reddit, Discord, and beyond. Today, BJJ black belt and jiu-jitsu supervillain Greg Souders joins me again to tackle this accusation. Greg has a very particular language he uses to describe training, jiu-jitsu movement, and to cue athletes during performance. Most of it is pulled from the scientific literature directly, but all of it is inspired by his studies across ecological dynamics and the separate but related focus of attention literature. A quick reminder, if you benefit from this show, consider going to combatlearning.com/support to buy me a coffee. This is a donation that supports the show, and I really, really appreciate it. Alternatively, you can support the show by joining the waiting list for the next cohort of combat learning workshops at combatlearning.com/waitlist. So if you're excited to jump in, hit the subscribe button on your podcatcher and enjoy the show. All right. Welcome back to the Combat Learning Podcast.
Thank you,
glad
sir.
Glad to have you.
I'm glad to be here.
Sweet. Okay, so I'm just going to jump right into it. We already introduced you last time around. Most people, I think, who find this podcast will be familiar with you already. So let's kind of do this as a sequel and talk about some of the emerging public criticism of you and your methodology and sort of address some of the stuff that's going on, unpack things and clarify things.
For sure.
One of those emerging criticisms is that and I've experienced this over the years too, is that how you speak is being construed as purposefully trying to confuse people. And you're being dismissed on those grounds. Now, that part is obviously wrong. Anybody who knows anything about reasoned discourse knows that that's very bad behavior. It's a fallacious behavior. But I do want to address why the way you speak sounds different and what the purpose is for.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to talk about that.
Cool.
So do you mean just fly off? Fly?
Let me just go. Fly, dude. Let's go.
All right. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to use the language of a science and apply it to a sport. So I'm not, these word choices are not mine. I'm using word choices from the science that's informing me on how to design practice, because my goal is to let people know that there's a source that I'm pulling this information from. Mm-hmm. And I want them to start hearing me use these words so that if they're interested in the source and they go back, they'll have some context. Oh, that's why he said this. That's what this means, right? Because I'm not educating people on ecology. What I'm trying to do is tell people how I use ecological dynamics and ecological psychology to inform practice design. So I'm trying to stay as true to what I'm reading and learning as I can. And I'm also practicing using the language because I'm a beginner educator. I'm trying to convey a message, and I have to practice that too. Mm-hmm. So it would be disingenuous of me to make up my own words for something that already exists. Anyway, so that's why I use the words that I do.
Yes. And that's with regard to terminology that conveys something about the ecological approach, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. And those things in the literature, even though they're not in, let's call it parlance, right? Let's use words that people don't like just to get
right. Good.
So instead of calling it common speech, I'm going to call it parlance. Those things are not those words are not commonly used, or at least not used in the same way. However, they do have very precise definitions in the literature. And so when you have your students, you correct me if I'm wrong, you explain to your students what those things mean.
Yes. If I decide to use a word that's outside of our community, I will let my students know what that means.
Okay.
Now, in my room, sometimes I don't use the science at all because I'm talking about jujitsu to them. I basically have three layers of student. Mm-hmm. I have the people coming in who want to see what jujitsu is all about and they want to learn the sport. To them, they don't get any of the science because they don't need it. They need to come in, try the physical thing out, see if they like the game, you know, try to focus on a task and try to learn something. Cool. Then I have the next layer. I have the people who become members. And so for them, I start to introduce little bits of why I do what I do. Like, for example, I like to talk about variability first. I like to tell students that when you're new, there's so much variability or change in a given situation that it can be difficult to know what to focus on. So in practice design, to try to reduce that crazy variability, we just focus on outcome. So we allow variability or change to exist because there is no perfect way to do something. And so anyway, I'll explain that to them. So this is why we're doing this, and this is what variability means. And so then I just slowly start to basically introduce the science as it's necessary for them as a learner. And then I have my students. These are the guys that are dedicated to the process. They want to understand, coach, why am I doing this? What do I need to think about? And within, we discuss the science. We talk about degeneracy. We talk about redundancy. We talk about affordances. We talk about specifying information and that is affordances. But we talk about why all those words are used and how we can use them here and how this relates to what we're looking at in the environment as we play. So again, I'm just trying. I don't know who I'm speaking to when I'm on a podcast, right? So I'm trying to do a sort of a mix of it all so you guys can see what I'm about. But again, they're taking this to mean a thousand different things.
Yeah. And it's dismissive, right? There's no questions. There's no intellectual curiosity. There's no benefit of the doubt. There's none of that. Which is what I find so the discourse is polarized because there aren't a lot of people who are just curious to understand what's going on and what they might be missing. And once we've explained it, they've asked the questions they might come to the conclusion that they haven't missed something. I don't think that's likely, but instead of not even giving the chance, it's just an immediate dismissal. Oh, this is why there's so much garbage instruction when people are getting hurt. Okay.
Well, nobody gets hurt at my gym. Like these criticisms people are making of me. So what I joke with my guys about Reddit. Reddit is like it's fairy tale land. And how fairy tale land works in Reddit is all the people with all these opinions, right? Mm-hmm. They formulate what they think in their mind is happening. And they paint this picture like a fairy tale, and then they argue with each other about the fairy tale. It's like, you're not even arguing about reality. Like you've never been here. You haven't seen anything but clips of what we do. A single class? Are you fucking joking? Do you know how much thought energy goes into how I design a day, a week, a month, a year? Get out of here. Anyway, so they're arguing about things they've never seen or done. You know, this is like trying to argue about what it might feel like to be on the moon and people having actual opinions about it. You've never been there. So anyway.
No, that reminds me of an engage. Well, your video, I put your video on Reddit recently and it blew up and I saw that you eventually jumped
they hate
in.
Me.
I don't think, did I send you the link? I don't think I sent you the link. I think you went and found it.
Oh, no, you sent me a screenshot of what people were saying and I was like, all right, I'll check it out. Yeah. I typically stay out of that shit. I don't read the comments, but you got me into it, jerk. And so this last 2 weeks, I've been fucking reading comments and I just, you know, I got lost in the comments.
I want to share my pain. I want to share my pain of engaging in the public discourse of training methodology. But no, I didn't send you the link because I just wanted you to see some dumb stuff. I didn't want you to like get involved, but you got involved anyways. It's fine.
It's okay. I jumped in a little bit, but then I was like, man, this is a waste of my fucking time. So I just backed out.
Yeah, it is a waste of time. But one of the things I found, so there's a clip I shared probably 2 months ago and the guy showed up and there were so many bad assumptions in everything he said. First of all, it was impossible for him to know the things he was assuming about the nature of your program. The clip was like 30 seconds.
Right.
And it was you describing how you put together an arm lock, how to understand how to control and create an arm lock, that game.
Sure.
And I said to him, first, you can't know any of that. And why wouldn't you just ask like a simple question, like, what am I missing? And he immediately engages in gaslighting and like projecting things on me. And I didn't say anything. I can be mean sometimes. I didn't say anything mean to him. I was just like, hey, dude, I don't understand why you're saying it this way. There's at least three questions you could ask before you came to this conclusion. And his immediate response was to basically act like an abusive person.
For sure.
And because gaslight they had no argument. Yeah. And gaslight me. And it was actual. And I'm not just saying that. He's literally trying to make me believe something that wasn't true. And then the funny thing is, and this is why I think that we're eventually going to win. The funny thing is a brown belt that outranked him. I think he's like a blue belt or a purple belt. Came in and like asked him a couple questions that sort of blew what he was saying out of the water. Then all of a sudden he deleted his entire account. Because yeah, on Reddit, they're insects. And if you get downvoted, they lose their nerve because the social temperature is not on their side. Mm-hmm. And so they either change their opinion or delete their account and reinvent themselves.
For sure. That's because they're not really building anything real. So the reason is I'm building something real. These people are telling me that I can't do what I'm literally doing. Like, it sounds so weird. It's like, oh, you could, there's no way a brand new person could learn like that. I have a fucking school full of them. Like, I don't understand because they think, and then this is where the fantasy line comes up. Like, well, there's no way. Souders is holding out. You know, he's having secret sessions and they're watching John Danaher DVDs and I know it. It's like, dude, you're insane. You're insane.
Yeah. The cope right now is that none of them are beginners.
Right. Well, okay. Because they see DeAndre, they see Gavin. And I don't know why the reason we're highlighting Dee and Gavin is because they are black belts. They've earned mm-hmm. their right to be at the highest level. And that's what we should show. When we look on TV and look at professional sports, we're not looking at D3 college level athlete or even developing high school athlete. We're not looking at them because they haven't earned their right yet to be in the spotlight to show the pinnacle of their actions. But Dee and Gavin are. And so they use that as a way to excuse what I'm doing as if they came in here like that when they didn't. Anyway, but I do have a room full of developing athletes who show great skill, and not just great skill, but a wide array of skills so early in their development mm-hmm. because of the way we train, right? Their creativity is high. Their accepting of variability is high. They get very consistent outcomes through novelty and random action. So I'm and they don't even know what any of that means. So again, I'm just like, I'm blown away. I'm like, all right, guys.
Yeah, I keep seeing the same. Yeah, that's totally true. It's whataboutism. It's true whataboutism. Asking a question, what about, is not necessarily whataboutism. What aboutism actually is when you say something like that for the pure purpose of giving yourself a flimsy excuse to not explore the idea. In other words, you want to maintain the status quo and you have no interest in considering the idea. By the way, I don't know if anybody knew this, but you don't have to believe an idea to consider it.
For sure. You can disagree.
Apparently you do. They keep telling me you do. I have the experience that you don't have to do that. But everyone else seems to think that in order to rationally consider an idea and to weigh it, you have to believe it. I don't know what the deal is with this, but apparently that's how people believe. But I want to circle back to your language. And I think that there is, there's another element to that. And it's not just your use of ecological dynamics terminology. It's also the way you have a unique way of describing the positions.
For sure.
So can you walk me through why it is you call something chest to chest instead of side control or a certain type of mound or whatever?
Yeah, it's because of degree. So the amount of degree between two points is infinite. So we can use positions like side control and mount to discuss steady states in a dynamic system. But mm-hmm. those names don't tell the whole story because they don't relate to the effect of the pin. Okay? So mm-hmm. pinning has to do with your degree of perpendicularity or parallelity, I don't know if that's a fucking word, or parallelity related to your ability to pin the hips, shoulders, chest, and back. So that's what's actually happening. So a body is covering a body at center mass at relative degrees to motion and the floor to accomplish mm-hmm. the task of pinning. So mm-hmm. chest to chest takes that whole degree in, because I don't know which point of my chest is side control. I don't know what degree is we like, is side control exactly, you know, 90, or is it, you know, 87 yeah. or is it 84? So, right. you know, and so that's why I just say chest to chest, because it lets the actor perceive that people know what chests are. We've been seeing chests our whole lives. So right. it's very easy for us to have a relationship with that direct information mm-hmm. if we're looking or focusing our attention on an mm-hmm. area that we're familiar with, right? So that's why I say chest to chest or chest to back. It gives a search zone or a task motor workspace for the body to organize around. I'm not saying it to be confusing. I'm yeah. saying it because we see chests. We don't see side control. That's IP. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like,
side control has to be first defined and then interpreted for you to understand what it is. But if I say chest yeah. to chest, but then all of a sudden we can just call this side control. And then the guy's like, oh yeah, okay, makes sense. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's sort of an embedded external focus of attention, because even though you reference your own chest, the focus is the other person's chest. When
right.
you're trying to pin somebody down, you actually understand where you're putting your chest, in a way that's really simple and that primes your attention in a visceral way, and not in a step one, step two, step three. I need to exactly. be focused on, oh, I have the shoulder of justice here, and I have this here, and I have this there. But oh, we can also do kese gatame, and we could do a scarf hold, and you can do it this way, and you can do it that way. Instead of being opinionated on how to do every movement correctly, you give the one correctly. Effect and exactly. you let them figure yes. out what works best for them.
That's correct, you know? And what I think these guys don't understand is where ecological dynamics started, and it was with the degrees of freedom problem. So yeah. the whole science was a way to look at how do we talk about the way we control degrees of freedom to produce an outcome, because they're so variable. How do we talk about this? And so I remember in my mind all the time, this is the problem we are solving with this science, right? So mm-hmm. we can solve the degrees of freedom problem by accepting degrees as it relates to effect or outcome or the effective outcome. So that's why I'm just trying to stay true to what problem we originally were trying to solve by using this method of thinking, mm-hmm. right?
Yes. So, yes.
The degrees and problem, we're still trying to solve it.
Right. And I think... so it's exceptionally descriptive, and it's not any, I think it's more precise than this side control, that side control.
It's far more precise,
but it's certainly not less precise, because side control can mean any number of positions.
That's what I mean. Like that, the degrees problem, like where, yeah. if you were to measure it and say, okay, this is side control. Is it the grips you have?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the degree to which you are perpendicular versus parallel? Is it the effect you're having? Where is the definitive measure of side control? Is it just the way it looks? So, and these are fine. We can call it side control. But when I'm training athletes, I don't want them to see side control. It's because one of the principles of constraints-led approach practice design is to constrain to afford. So what that means is we need to limit options relative to specifying information. And mm-hmm. so I have to get students to focus their attention to pick that up. You can't pick up side control. Like it's not a thing. So anyway, mm-hmm. we can use that language as a definitive term to agree upon in the community. But when you're training an athlete, you need them to focus in a specific area relative to effect. And so that it does that better. Mm-hmm. Again, even though it's more specifying, it's not specifying as a steady state or a very particular alignment, but to a degree of effectiveness. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's how I think about it.
Real quick before I put you back into the podcast, want to take your knowledge and practice of the ecological or constraints-led approach to the next level? Go to combatlearning.com/waitlist to join the waiting list for our combat learning workshops. You'll have direct access to me to work through the problems you're experiencing on your mat or bounce off ideas. And you'll collaborate with other coaches who are working through the same problems. The waiting list for the second cohort of my combat learning workshops is now open. The first cohort filled up quick. There might be one or two spots still open if they don't reply, but this one likely will fill up too. Don't wait. because there might not be a third cohort and there definitely won't be a fourth. Go to combatlearning.com/waitlist, W-A-I-T-L-A-I-S-T, to ensure you get to the next cohort. I think that makes sense. For me, the problem of, and what I like about the way you describe things and you talk about teaching alignments rather than moves, is that you get, in auditing my own journey in jiu-jitsu and through martial arts, you get the false impression that a single instantiation of side control that has specified proper technique of all these things you have to focus on with your arms and your legs and everything, that you have to be in that position for any length of time. And right, that if it doesn't work well for you, there's something deficient about you automatically, rather than something about the relationship between your opponent and the task that's making it hard for you. And exactly. So I've always struggled with a traditional standard side control with the hand under the head and you're at a perpendicular angle and you're trying to keep your hips close, but you're not trying to let them have their elbow in. Just maintaining that. Heavy people have a great, they can do that easy, but I've always had trouble maintaining that. And I always move immediately to something else because
for sure,
guys can force their elbow in and press me away if they are anywhere, if they are more heavy than me at all. It's just easy for them to force their elbow in and start pushing me away.
Well, it's because all that matters about pinning is the effect you're having over your opponent. So we have to know where to focus our attention so that we can have that effect, right? Yeah. And then that effect changes body size, psychological predisposition, skill level. It changes. So I have to find ways to adapt to the novelty that's present as the situation changes. Mm-hmm. And if my only definition is this specific grip alignment thing, then I don't know what to adjust. Because if I'm only ever looking for this exact final piece, then where do I adjust when things go wrong? And you can't see the whole picture, you end up becoming blind to it. So, so I don't know, that's what it is. And the thing is, and people think I'm crazy when I say this, but I'm just going to say it and we can talk about it if you want, but there's no such thing as side control. Yeah. There's only pinning. And pinning is a relationship between where you are relative to your opponent, relative to the floor. And so that can happen in a 360 degree circle around the body with different grips, different structures, different movement patterns, different alignments. So as long as a pin can be had, then it's effective. That's all we care about. We don't need side control. We need to pin. So
yeah,
again, people are going to hear this. They're not going to understand it. And of course I'm speaking whatever, but this is how we learn it. Yeah. This is why my guys are effective at performing.
Yeah, the effect is what matters, not the aesthetics. And with people who are bigger than me, this goes away when somebody's more skilled than me, but I've always had more success transitioning to north-south because people have such a problem dealing with that position specifically. And I'm pretty good at holding somebody in north-south unless they're really skilled. So,
let's talk about why that
works better for me.
No, I'll tell you why. I can give you a physically certain reason as to why that is easier for you to do against a bigger opponent, right? So we use four general human movements to release ourselves from the floor, okay? We use limb extension, limb contraction, rotation, and basing. Okay, these are the basic movements you could break the body down to. Now, when you're in side control, essentially you're still in front of pushing and retracting things. So you're in front of the limbs and their ability to push and retract is very high there. Okay. Now, when you go north-south, you're further from their legs. Okay. And you're at an awkward angle for their arms. So pushing becomes a little bit more difficult in a direction. Now, they can push you straight up, but that does not change your alignment relative to them. Whereas in side control, they can push you away, which changes your alignment relative to them. So this is why that effect is had. It's because of what's possible or what the alignment affords you relative to their resistance. And so that's why. And so really what you change which one of those four things you're dealing with to a certain degree as you change alignments. So we could say that in a north-south position, you're going to have to deal with rotation and knee retraction more than you're going to have to deal with pushing. Right. But in side control, that changes. And with mount, that changes. And mount, you're going to have to deal with pushing more. So again, it's just the way human body, when they line up, is the effect of the system. So
And when I hold somebody in north-south, so they can, they're in an awkward angle to press away your hips, it's really difficult for them to get to turn and sort of crunch and get their knees in, which is a good way to get someone away. And so especially they have to expend way, especially if they're bigger, they have to be more precise and expend more energy in order to get me off, which puts me in an advantageous position as a smaller person. So, sure. Yeah. And I didn't know that when north-south was just something you occasionally did when I did the traditional learning of jiu-jitsu, but it's something when I was able to do more live practice that I, especially in no-gi, when I lost the gi control, I started finding myself in north-south way more naturally.
Right. So we've erased these. So this is how we discuss it now. So once we segment the periphery and gain access to center mats, okay, this is the hips, chest, shoulders, and back. Our job is to keep the hips, chest, and shoulders covered, if we're behind them on the back, the hips, back, and shoulders covered, and by getting our legs involved as soon as possible. The way we start to discuss this is that side control and north-south in their traditional elements, as they're explained, are incomplete. They're incomplete because they're the two alignments where you have mostly your arms involved. Now, mount and back mount, as stereotypical positions, your legs and arms are directly involved in the pinning process at all times. But again, side control and north-south, not necessarily in their traditional forms. So what we talk about, again, is once the periphery is passed and we gain access to center mass, our job is to keep the hips and shoulders, chest and back covered at all times and getting our legs involved in that process as soon as possible. So this allows us a little more freedom of movement and it focuses us on the effect of just holding them there for a specific end rather than getting to side control, rather than getting to mount, rather than transitioning to north-south. Again, because these things disappear once the degrees of freedom are allowed to exist. It's going to be an amalgamation of all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking in terms of how to apply that to striking. And it occurred to me that this changes depending on the rule set. So constraints has a big deal on what affordances are available and how you can use the rules of the game to help certain tactics emerge. But it occurred to me that, for example, in sport taekwondo, with the electronic scoring system, there are only certain legal scoring areas. And not only are they the only legal scoring areas, but they're the only possible scoring areas. Because if you don't hit with that area, it won't score. And so we spend so much time trying to perfect the hip turnover and the trajectory of the knee so that you can throw a round kick with an almost perfect horizontal trajectory.
Okay.
However, the intrinsic constraints of the kick created by the striking surface makes it impossible for you to score if you don't do that. So if you put people in the gear and give them an effect or a task parameter, you need to hit this part of the foot to the chest gear. They have no choice but to find a way to create that trajectory because the feedback of not registering a point forces them to try different things with the way they organize their bodies. You don't have to go through the awful chambering sequence. I don't know if you've ever did karate or anything, but it's awful and it doesn't look like a real kick. And it really doesn't help you do a real kick.
I agree. I used to do like Kyokushin and shit when I was a kid, but nothing like, I was an aggressive kind of kid who liked to fight. So I was always looking for that kind of stuff. And anyway, I did like full contact karate or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And they have roughly the same teaching methods. They just do more sparring, which is better.
Yeah. And that's not, but I was a little kid. I don't remember. We just sparred and I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah. The sparring parts was fun. The doing kicks on the wall that's not fun.
Well, because like a training is the game. Like, you know, training is the game of, in your case, taekwondo, and you know, in my case, grappling. But again, it's weird. I don't understand why people think training is going outside the game. This is another language that people are like saying, they keep using the word game like we're not already playing one. And that frustrates me so bad. Mm-hmm. Badly here.
Yeah. Or they say we're already doing that, which makes me upset
too. Then why aren't you doing it? Why aren't you talking about it? Like, why are your students getting mashed by my students? If you're already doing what I'm doing, why can't you tell me what I'm doing? Like it's yeah. A situational spying. That's all it is.
It's like, yeah, I know. Fuck. If you're already doing it, why are you arguing with me?
Right. You'd be, oh yeah, cool. We're doing that too. Congratulations, man.
Why is there an argument at all?
Right. Exactly. Nobody argues what they're already doing. The problem is first, they think that I'm saying I'm doing something new. I'm doing something new in our sport. I'm not doing anything new globally. Okay. This is, this has been being used for 100 years in varying degrees, right? Varying different formations and methodologies.
Right.
I'm never claiming that. I'm just saying I'm introducing this science to our sport because it doesn't exist here yet. And then you get these guys, and then you get the SBG guys, which they're fine. Actually, I don't have any beef with really anybody except the static drilling crew. They're stupid. But, you know, the SBG guys, their problem is they still don't know why they're doing what they're doing. They just recognize that you had to really play the game and it had to be live, which is great. Yeah. That's the foundation, right? But then they add in weird things like progressive resistance.
Mm-hmm.
My argument is that doesn't exist. Because how do we objectively calculate it? Because resistance itself is progressive. Right? If I put 2 minutes on and say fight, aggression would be high. We can just say high because I don't know to which degree. If we put long time in, as it progresses, energy will progressively get lower. Yeah. Energy is different at the beginning of training than it is at the end of training. Energy outputs are different in guarded situations than they are in pinning situations. So energy is already progressive. It's a progressive state. The human action. As the body heats up, it gets introduced to fatigue. As fatigue waxes and wanes throughout the thing, as your breath changes, as your everything changes, your force is progressive. And your force is never absolute or not absolute. It's always relative to the task. So to say progressive resistance is to miss the point. It's to miss the force because the trees are in the way. Right?
Yeah.
The thing, what they really want to say is they want to try to control energy output. But by telling someone a random metric like 37%, this doesn't even come close to scratching it because we don't have a mechanism for that. We have mechanisms to use to control intensity, to progressively gain resistance or whatever, but it's not by talking about it.
Mm-mm. No, and everyone's perception is different.
Again, everyone's physical ability is different. Everyone's perception is different. Everyone's athletic, I mean, everything is different. You never have the same condition. Like the conditions are always changing.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you can say you have a metric for something that is so variable we can't measure it. Like what?
Yeah.
And they don't see that. They're like, we've been doing this forever. Oh, you've been doing it wrong forever. We understand. That's why nobody's paying attention to you. Like, I mean, I'm not dissing them. Like, it's just like, come on, guys. Think about this for 5 seconds or look at what I'm saying. Look at what the scientists are saying. And let's talk about it again. Let's talk about it again. Let's help each other grow and figure this shit out. What's actually happening?
Nobody's really noticed it or pointed it out yet. But I appreciate, I interviewed Matt on the podcast, right? I appreciate his work popularizing aliveness, getting it into the public sphere. However, his definition of aliveness is vague and insufficient. When I started talking about aliveness, and I realized this because there's some really, jiu-jitsu has this problem too, but there's a lot of specific problems specific to traditional martial arts around the notion of resistance. That's what the term they use for aliveness. They start to use the word aliveness now too, because there's a lot of cross-pollination. But I had to redefine aliveness for myself in the way I use it, because people, you can rejig the, timing, energy, and motion idea. That's how they define aliveness to mean almost anything. And so I had to define it as not three things, but two things that must always exist in tandem.
Okay.
If they do not exist together, it is broken, and that is unscripted and uncooperative.
Dude, I love it. That's so easy.
Yeah. Oh my God. If it's not self-determined and antagonistic or competitive, then it is not alive, because it won't produce accurate tactical behavior.
Agree. Oh my God. See, you know, what's funny is you and Seneca, right? Because I love the way Seneca writes, right? We haven't spoken. I don't know if he likes me very much because I'm abrasive and he seems like a really nice, passive guy. But I really appreciate the way you guys discuss things. I truly do. I read all your shit. because it's like you come from a different sport than us. You guys have a more traditional approach anyway. And I feel like your sport's a little more constrained and the resistances are different. And so to hear you guys have such a clear understanding of what's happening, it's beautiful. It makes me feel good. You know? That's why if you notice, look at the way I'm talking to you on this podcast and look at the way I'm talking to the other people. I get frustrated very easily because like you haven't even begun to educate yourself and you want to challenge something you don't understand. But I'm thrilled to talk to you because whether we see eye to eye, if we ever do or don't, whatever, I know that you will be prepared to defend what you say with reason and you will accept mine and we will be able to go back and forth. This is, anyway, good job, man. I love it. I agree. I love it. I love it.
Thanks.
Yeah, man.
A little bit of a bromance moment here on the podcast.
We got to have them, man. We got to let them know there are dudes that fucking agree.
Yeah. Well, we need a front for all these bad actors because otherwise we're just going to get isolated and our influence will be stifled. But switching gears here, when you want to explore a skill and create a new game or a series of games around that skill, where do you start? How do you approach putting together the task parameters or the rules of the game?
Thanks so much for listening to the Combat Learning Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. It really helps us out. Finally, this episode, including the intro music, is produced by Micah Peacock. Thanks in advance, and I'll see you on the next episode.